Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and streaming of primo local content. Download the accessmedia.nz app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, resilience on radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, resilience on radio. Broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight, and me, Samuel Mann. Shane's not here because I'm in Hong Kong. I'm at the IA4 conference on higher education research
and sustainability. Right.
And I am in the room of Prof. Dean Neubauer, who is an emeritus professor of political science at University of Hawaii, Manoa, and is a senior adjunct fellow at the East-West Centre. And his bio has got a long list of things that he's interested in and a long list of books that he's written. And we'll talk about some of those things. Thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in southeastern Wisconsin in a community that was partially Danish. My grandmother was Danish and had a significant German component. My grandfather was German. I was third generation and grew up in a world in which people who weren't Danish and German seemed foreign.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, a baseball player, and spent a lot of time trying to do that. It wasn't until many years later that I realized that all the hits that were coming off of my pitching arm probably had something to do with the fact that I wouldn't get very far at that endeavor.
And what did you do after you gave up on that idea?
Well, my life changed dramatically. I went to high school in Milwaukee, which is a much larger city. And through the accidents of how residence is established in American cities, I went to, I'd grown up a rather poor working class, but I ended up going to a middle class high school and living with my grandmother. And at that time, I began to see that the world was larger than I had been led to believe. And then my family moved to California, and I realized that it was much larger than I had grown to believe. I got drafted into the American Army, and after my 2 years, I got out and became an undergraduate at the University of California, Riverside, which was the smallest of the campuses at that time. That turned out to be the accident that changed my life, because we had this very, very small faculty of really extraordinary people, and they reached inside my brain and started to rearrange it, and then began to suggest to me that I might want to go to graduate school, something I had not considered to that point, and led me to being able to fellowships, which allowed me to go to Yale, where I took my master's and PhD. And when I then got out, I joined the University of California, one of its new campuses at Irvine, which is in Southern California, close by to Newport Beach. And I was there for 4 years, and then I was able to get a fellowship to go to University College London. And I studied there under a remarkable woman, Mary Douglas, a famous anthropologist. And the conclusion of that, some colleagues in Hawaii suggested that I might want to come out there. I knew very little about Asia, and I thought, well, that would be interesting. And so I did, intending for 2 years, and I've now been there for. I was doing some research at the time, comparative research on a number of countries, and I knew very little about Asia. And so I thought I'd go out there for a couple of years. I had an offer to go to Berkeley, which at that time was King of the Hill. And so that was very attractive to me as a young person. And I went to Hawaii, and be careful with the language here, I got seduced by in the way that many people have who have gone to Hawaii, and ended up staying there for my whole academic career.
Fun journey.
Yeah, it was. And I'm leaving out the funnest part, which was the fact that I met my wife in my second year there, and she and I have now been married for some 40-some years, in a wonderful marriage.
When you went to Yale, because master's and PhD at Yale, what did you study?
Political science. I had gone to Yale at that time, the senior professor in the department was a man named Robert Dahl, and he had written a book which had totally captured my attention called A Preface to Democratic Theory. And so when I got the opportunity, I won a fellowship, and I was able to go there. Fortunately, I was accepted, and Bob became my senior mentor. And I wrote my dissertation under him and out of his work. So I went to California, and the University of California determined to pursue that work, which was comparative democratic theory. I joined Irvine at a time when it was unique in the world. James March, who's a famous sociologist who was a dean, was putting together an interdisciplinary program. And Jim had a number of brilliant ideas, one of which was, if you want to do interdisciplinary research, you shouldn't have your office next to a person who's in the same discipline as you, because that's where you end up talking story. So we had a scrambled, and my dearest next-door neighbor was a young female anthropologist. And I got in conversations with her over the years, and about a year and a half later, she said to me, kind of with her tongue in cheek, "So what do you really want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "I'm still trying to figure that out." She said, "You know what I think is you're not really a political scientist." And I said, "Well, that's pretty smart alecky on your part. What am I?" And she said, "I think you're a budding anthropologist." And so working on her provocation, as it was, I decided I would try to go to University College and study with Mary Douglas, who at that time was one of the three perhaps best-known anthropologists in the world. And she had written a book, which I still consider one of the great classics of anthropology, called Natural Symbols. And Natural Symbols was about how we make up the world symbolically. And so I went to study with her for a year, and she convinced me that I probably really wasn't a political scientist, but I was interested in social phenomena. So when I went to Hawaii, I went with an agreement with the department that, because I was in a political science department, that in one semester I teach the undergraduate course in policy studies, and in the other semester, we have a two-semester system, I teach the graduate course. And other than that, I could make up courses. And so for about 5, 6, 7 years running, I made up these courses that I call politics and then you filled in the blank as to what the and was. When I was at Irvine, I created a course with a colleague of mine called The Politics of Everyday Life. And what we would then do is to look at the way that people organize themselves in their everyday affairs and try to get our students to see that there are political dimensions to almost everything that people do. And then, so I taught that course for a while, and then, as I say, I started teaching the politics and politics and drama, politics and the novel, politics and total institutions, et cetera, et cetera. And that took me to a number of directions. I then got interested in, this was a time in the United States when the alternative healthcare movement was very strong. And so I got involved in the proposition that if you have an alternative view of the body and the body as it interacts in society, do you also have an alternative political ideology? And so I did some work on that for a number of years. And so that led me down a path in which I then got involved in health politics, the politics of global agriculture, political economy. And then when the 80s came along, we began to see what would become the phenomena of globalization. And so I had a discussion group at the university that I was part of, and we pursued that for quite a while. And then one day one of my senior colleagues said, you know, Dean, what you should do is to create a globalization study center. So I did. And that then led to another engagement with a global network of globalization centers, if you will. And by the time I left that activity, we had 45 around the world. And then another part of my biography, since you've been kind enough to ask, is I became a reluctant administrator at my university. I got drafted to be my department chair, and then I got drafted to reorganize our College of Arts and Sciences, which had 42 departments, and we broke them down into four units, one of which was social sciences. And then I got drafted to be the dean of social sciences, and et cetera, et cetera. So I followed that path, ending up as the chancellor at our university campus at Manoa, and then simultaneously as vice president for academic affairs for a 10-campus system. In 2014, I thought, well, enough is enough, and so I'm sorry, 2004, I decided to retire. And just at that time, my colleagues at the East West Center were doing these experiments in global education. And they talked me into being part of that. And so since 2005, I have been retired from the university but associated with the East West Center in this project which studies aspects of education globally.
When we talk about things like sustainability,
right,
it's inherently interdisciplinary.
Correct.
Do we need to change structures to be able to consider those sorts of things?
Absolutely.
When you talk about globalization, are you talking about free trade? Are you talking about connections through the internet? Yeah. Is it the whole lot?
Well, actually, what I am doing in that construct is looking at the way the world changed in the post-World War II period, and primarily through the integration of Europe into the common market, but then increasingly also into the economic power of the United States, Germany, and Japan from the 1970s onward to reorganize the world in a variety of ways. One of the ways that the world was reorganized was to make it easier to move money from place to place, both real money, investment money, and legal money, which is a whole thing in the world that people talk about all too little, is the extraordinary degree to which the wealth of the world is held behind the dark curtain. So the globalization that we were pursuing was the way in which the national origins of rules, lives, behaviors, wealth, etc., were extended across national borders into something else. And so I have over here on my table the Globalization and Its Discontents, revisited Joseph Stiglitz's famous book. And Joseph has done as good a job, I think, in laying out what the globalization endeavor was, but also then documenting the nationalist resurge, which has occurred in the last 5 to 8 years in various places, not the least of which has been with the emergence of China as a global power. And then more recently with the incredible phenomenon that we have in the United States of Trumpism and what that retreat from the agreements which had brought the world together and characterized globalization. So we have a beginning from maybe 1965-70, we have the emergence of globalization being largely on the back of the Japanese economy and the German economy. And then we have that transition period where China begins to emerge and reorganize the world. And now we're really in a third period. And that third period is the reemergence of nationalism and a rejection, at least a formal pragmatic rejection, of globalization in the name of various kinds of national identities. With respect to the American instance, I do not think that the Trump administration has anything that could be dignified by calling it an ideology. Rather, it is a set of behaviors which has had the pragmatic effect of disrupting global ties. And that then leads to a whole variety of other places, and part of those places is what Joe talks about in this recent book, which is stimulating in various countries the political activity of those who have been economically left behind. And what's happening in the United States is that the white working class has been significantly left behind, as it were, economically, by the movement of many industries, both technologically and physically, out of the United States, leaving those people without occupations and incomes. That has created a politics of resentment, and that politics of resentment is largely what has fueled the Trump administration. One can look at similar kinds of arguments with some important differences in Poland, in Hungary, in parts of Germany. Globalization has not, has had winners and losers, as we are wont to say. And in many places where the losers have fueled those who are willing to pick up the cudgels of redefinition, such as in Brazil and Venezuela, etc., to promote a kind of post-globalization nationalism, which is meant to repair the ills of this, what is now seen by them as a failed experiment. I think it's infinitely more complex than that, but the superficial ideologies are built around those understandings.
Even if when the cartoon at the top of that goes away in a year or 4 years, 5 years, is that politics of resentment genie out of the bottle?
Yes.
So how do we deal with the big questions like climate change, sustainability, all those sorts of things in that new structure?
Well, I'm just chatting with someone at the conference yesterday after a talk, and we were saying, what does it take to get people to take sustainability seriously? What does it take to get people to deal with climate change in a realistic political manner? And I found myself saying something which I really believe. Earlier in my career as a political scientist, I was very much convinced that two kinds of things proceed in the ordinary world. One is that irrespective of the culture and institutional differences, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the political life of most societies at most times is based upon iteration. We do what we know how to do, and then we make marginal adjustments to that. Iteration takes us to a lot of interesting places. One of the places you can do is to iterate yourself right to a cliff face. And if you iterate two steps too far, you find yourself falling down the precipice into the river. So utilizing that metaphor, you ask the question, well, if what we do most of the time is iteration, and this, by the way, is been sanctified in a good deal of American economic theory, how do you get real change? And the answer is you have a crisis. And what a crisis does is say to people, business as usual ain't working anymore, and we got to do something different. So the good side of crisis is that you promote change. The bad side of crisis is that it's usually very, very messy. So just before you and I decided to depart for this conversation, we were chatting with some people who had gone to downtown Hong Kong last night, where there was a good deal of head bashing and confrontations with the police, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's a crisis that is happening, and it's happening in part because the people involved do not want to be participant in the iterative political process, which was on its way to a different outcome than they wanted. And as they tried to use the conventional political system to stop that, they found that with the current system in place, the political institutions, the leadership of the LAM, the mayor, etc., that they could not, in fact, get the outcome that they wanted. And so they have come to the conclusion that they have to disrupt the political system. They have to create a crisis in order to try to get the outcome that they want. So if we say, just for the sake of this conversation, that there is a logic there that one can fill with a good deal of examples and go back to the issue of climate, at what point do we begin to change human behavior such that it can deal with climate change? And I reference you in this regard to what's been happening over the last month in California, because what we're now doing is burning down California. And the conditions which produce those fires in California are directly a consequence, in a highly demonstrable way with conventional science, of climate change that has brought about a change in the weather pattern, which has brought about a change in rainfall in California, so that the dry season is much drier. And as I was talking to someone yesterday about, when I was an undergraduate living in Southern California, we experienced the Santa Ana winds because they've been there forever. But they were typically about 25, 35, sometimes 40 miles an hour. The Santa Ana winds that were blowing in California last week were 70 and 80 miles an hour. So you start a fire on bone-dry forest land, and the fire leaps up, and then you start to fuel that, as it were, with a 70-mile-an-hour wind, and suddenly you have a conflagration. And that's what's happened. We're now in the third year of that, etc. One of the I want to just use this as an opportunity to say once again the ineffectiveness of our American national government in response to this. When the when the President of the United States was forced to comment or induced to comment upon this, he suggested that the solution to this did not reside in dealing with climate change, but in cleaning up the leaves on the forest floor. So what we have in the political leadership in the United States is one of the great climate deniers of the current period.
In your talk, you talked about one of the elements being the challenges to the truth.
Yeah.
Where's that come from? Is that part of this response to globalization? Is it people don't like the direction, so they're making up their own stories?
I think there are three convergent elements here. One of them is to go to school on the Nazi regime, and Goebbels in particular, and to realize that Goebbels was kind of a perverse genius of symbolic manipulation. He had figured out how to make people behave in a certain kind of way that was useful for those who controlled the state by controlling the means of communication. So what people see and speak is a precursor to what they do. Now, what I think we are currently involved in the structures of communication and what I call the challenge of truth are three things that are happening simultaneously. One is the fact that the brand new institutions, as it were, of the internet, of especially Facebook and Twitter, have created something that, you know, easy to say, hard to appreciate intellectually, are absolutely new. Human populations have never had the opportunity to communicate in this way. We are defining a new way for humans to be in the world. But because it is so regular, because it is so part of everyday life, because it is so ordinary to send a Facebook page to my wife or my daughter or whatever, we see it as a trivial part of everyday life. The reality is that it is anything but. It is a fundamentally different, novel way to organize interactions within human society. And as a result of that novelty, as a result of that phenomena, what we are doing is generating new kinds of behaviors. So one of the things I talked about yesterday was what my colleagues at Berkeley and UCLA are concerned about, which have been called deep fakes. The other thing I was pointing to yesterday is that we now have just irrefutable evidence that the Russians have spent a good deal of time, effort, energy to create an entity which invented about 5-6 years ago, but which continues to be active, which has as its purpose the creation of false information on Facebook and other social media platforms designed to discredit, to promote certain kinds of views and to discredit others. We now know irrefutably that these had a major effect on the 2016 American election, and we now have many people who are arguing that they're going to have the same effect on the 2020 elections. And that the devices that currently exist within the United States are incapable of dealing effectively with that. So here we are in a situation that is absolutely unique, never existed before, that we're going to have a major, crucial, critical election in the United States, which will determine the fate of the country over the next number of years. And we know on the front side that that election is going to be fundamentally distorted and tarnished by an external power, and that we do not have the means for combating that. And within the Trump administration, we don't even have a willingness to admit that that possibility exists. So that's a crisis of a fundamental proportion.
Back to your crisis generating change. Is it a crisis that's going to deliver a change?
Hard to say.
If we look at things like the problems that sustainability is hoping to fix, climate change, biodiversity collapse, whatever, those are happening both locally and globally.
Of course.
And we need to fix them locally and globally.
Of course.
Going back to the thing from the 70s.
Right.
Do we actually have a model of thinking globally, acting locally?
Yes and no. We have partials, and I have a colleague at the University of Hawaii, for example, Carl Kim, who has done a significant amount of work in trying to coach communities in having a sensible notion of response to sustainability. And he has done that by promoting what sounds like a simple conceptual change to move from sustainability to resilience. But in Carl's framework, it's quite a bit more than that. To be resilient is to be aware of the fact that the environment in which you are in is going to provoke you in a variety of ways to respond. And should you wish to respond effectively, you then have to understand both the nature of the threat, if you will, and the possible resources and avenues of response to allow you to sustain yourself, to conflate the two. And you sustain yourself by proving that you've been resilient to the threat. That is interesting to work on conceptually. Once we get into the global phenomena, such as sea level rise, it's infinitely more difficult to deal with, because the and here I think is for me the crux of the issue. On the one hand, you have relatively a good science being able to increasingly make arguments about what produces the phenomena that you're trying to engage, but you have a whole variety of political responses to that, which are motivated by many other kinds of things that prohibit you from dealing with that as an effective national, international, global response. And there's no simple answer to that. You and I sit here, I just want to say this part, you and I sit here being concerned about this and maybe even losing sleep about it, but in order to get here, we have contributed to the problem by taking the airplanes that brought us here. So do we need to live in a world where we don't have air travel anymore? To live in a world in which, in order to spend the global calories, as you will, that you and I are going to spend on air travel, we have to recover them somewhere else? Do we have to have budgets that we can be responsible for, et cetera? Well, a number of climate scientists say yes, that the only way that we're going to resolve this issue is if we literally stop people from doing many of the things that produce the causal agents which produce the crisis in the first instance.
My problem with the use of resilience is it's too easy to go from resilience to that resurgence of nationalist type barricades, resilience in a castle.
I get it. And Carl and I have had this conversation. Carl has been the recipient of a major grant from the United States government in which he has worked with state universities through across the country to try to provide within the community settings in which they find themselves effective indicators. Now, what does that mean? It means the things that people can point to, understand, measure, and engage that will have an effect in some way on the kind of environmental crisis that they're facing. To take an example which is perhaps used to be thought of as one of the most difficult examples, and now the context has changed, and that's the pollution of fresh water through pesticide runoff. It turns out that once you turn your attention to that, you can invent various models for that, which can be then linked to behavioral engagements, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's an area that where you can have an environmental effect, which is positive. If, on the other hand, the issue that you're trying to deal with, for example, is doing something about the mangrove swamps in southern Louisiana, good luck. Because then what you're dealing with, again, is the effect of sea level rise compounded by these fundamental changes in the weather, which have been catastrophic.
In some ways, I often think that we almost did ourselves a disadvantage by fixing the ozone hole, because it was a simple thing. Yep. It was the first global issue, but it was a reasonably simple thing to fix.
Yep.
And so now we've got this idea that somehow technology is going to fix climate change.
Yep.
I want to come back to the politics of resentment. The messaging around sustainability is mostly one of less. It's use less things, travel less, whatever.
Right.
And that would seem to me to be fueling that politics of resentment.
Right.
If you're telling people they're going to have to do
without.
Right. So how can we move the conversation to one of thriving, a socio-ecological restoration, a positive outcome? A, is that possible? And B, how do we achieve that?
Well, that's, as we say in the American context, that's a $64,000 question. It's the right question to ask. And it turns out that on the way to $64,000, you get first, $1,200 and whatever. So you pick away at it. The one part of picking away at it is, first of all, to convince people that an issue exists of which they are a part. And the American experience is that this is vastly more difficult than the simple saying of it would suggest. So we've invented the notion of climate deniers, for example. But it goes far beyond that. It goes to the point that the conventions, and once again I'm going to talk about the United States, the conventions of modern American life are such that you live in a world in which the vast proportion of your activities are created by institutions and actors who are far away from where you are. And that goes from, the breakfast cereal that you pour into your bowl in the morning to what you decide to look at when you turn on the television. It's every aspect of contemporary complex American life has the elements which detract from the local, as you were, and put you into larger external environments. So that the first thing tends to be required is some kind of shift in consciousness in which people begin to reassert control over their local environment. And that is simple to say, it's extraordinarily difficult to do, particularly since the politics at the higher levels of the system militate against that at almost all times. But rather than just to give up and bang your head against the wall, what many people are arguing, certainly what the sustainability people in my university would argue, is that you begin by, in our case, by reminding people that they live on an island, and that everyone who lives on an island is an actor in terms of the degree to which that island is sustainable. Now, one of the things that happens in the island context, and with all due respect to my New Zealand colleagues who are in a similar situation, what we find then is that we have a politics, which is a really significant and divisive politics, in which those people who are most concerned about environmental questions find themselves arrayed against those in the society who see themselves as organized in terms of their life and their perception and their work in terms of continuing to create economic benefit. So the folks in our urban and regional planning department at the university would argue that what you need at the local level is a conversation, which is an enduring conversation in which people not only face up to what their role is as participants in the local environment, but they must learn, and here the imperative is important, they must learn to respect the fact that the others with whom they engage are not going away. So in the American experience, if you really, 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 really don't like where you are, you go somewhere else. In the island experience, if you really, really, really don't like where you are, you really don't have anywhere to go. So you have to change that social arrangement. So if we look at the politics of Hawaii at the moment, what we are dealing with, and once again, one can see this in a variety of ways in New Zealand as well, is the fact that the society is constructed out of those who have been here for a long time, those who are more recent arrivals, those who come in from the outside and want to consume the environment, et cetera, et cetera. We in Hawaii looked with very considerable interest at the recent decision on the part of the government of New Zealand to put barriers on home buying by people from outside New Zealand. We have a very similar issue in Hawaii because significant amounts of, certainly on Oahu, but other islands as well, the new construction is being created by and utilized by people who are external to the environment. So the reason I say it's a complex issue is because politics, in addition to often creating change by crisis, is about making a determination about who us is, who's the us in this in equation. If we're seeking to have resilience and sustainability, who's the us who's doing the seeking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, back to the globalization issue. Globalization as a phenomenon for over 2.5 decades was on the presumption that what we were doing was creating a world of increasing fluidity and mobility from society to society. Anti-globalization is in part about we've got to husband our own resources, which include our way of life, and protect that from those who would threaten it from the outside.
In terms of determining who the us is, we're not very good at thinking intergenerationally. We're not very good about thinking about the people that made our clothes in Cambodia.
Yeah, well, I can say that I agree entirely. The as a social scientist teaching in a university, I have found myself over the years seeking to create discourses with my students about precisely that question. Who is us? How did we get to be us? And on what moral, ethical, and normative basis should we seek to organize and control society such that us can be perpetuated? Now, if you just take that part and go into contemporary global politics, you're smack dab in the middle of immigration issues, as has not been the case very often over the last 4 or 5 decades. And I say that fully knowledgeable of the kinds of dislocations that resulted from the Vietnam War, et cetera, et cetera. But what's happening in the world today in terms of refugee crises are really a dramatic instance and reminder of the fact that that however the US is framed, it is eminently and constantly contingent. And politics in almost every country is based in part upon the legitimacy of that contingency, if I can use that awkward phrase. To what extent do we allow that contingent nature to be opened and to be redefined, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? I talked at the beginning when you asked me where I was from about my grandparents, both of whom were immigrants, one from Germany and one from Denmark. On my mother's side, the immigrants were from England. I noticed just by looking at you that you don't look very Polynesian, so I assume that you have some Caucasian immigration issues that make you up as well, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we tend to come into the world, our contemporary world, as adults, and we have a lot of incentives in us to forget where we came from in terms of those historical instances and how that affects where we are now and the world migration crisis that we are currently in, I think, is one of the great tragedies that is not being dealt with in the world.
Some questions to end with. Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
Not really. And by that, I mean that I think generically sustainability means the ability to do in some future instance that which was both possible and appropriate in a past instance. That's part A. Part B is that sustainability is defined by the boundaries of the phenomena which is meant to be sustainable. So what is interesting and important about the current situation that we're in is that perhaps for the first time, I'd have to think more carefully about that, but perhaps for the first time, the issue of global sustainability is both viable and quantifiable and fundamental in that the phenomena to which it is directed, such as sea level rise and weather, et cetera, crosses national boundaries. So once you've heated up the Pacific Basin, those hurricanes go hither and yon, and they don't have much respect for where they go. The sense of sustainability that I think is critical for us to appreciate in where we are currently is that environmental science is vastly more sophisticated in providing us with realistic, sensible, scientifically based, if you will, descriptions and explanations for the phenomena that we wish to address, and that our knowledge of these continues to grow apace, so that the ability of human populations to point to these catastrophic events and and not be part of them as grown smaller and smaller. I've just finished an interesting book by an American columnist, a television commentator, actually, Rachel Maddow, called Blow Up. And it is largely an argument about the degree to which American politics has been dominated by the extraction industry. But a significant proportion of it has been to look at the phenomena of fracking, which is the creating deep horizontal boring in the earth to find trapped deposits of oil and particularly gas. And one of the consequences for this has been to create significant amounts of earthquakes. And what was interesting is last week in Britain, it was announced that a moratorium was to be imposed on fracking because it had created so many earthquakes in places that they hadn't occurred for generations and generations. So what does this have to do with sustainability? And my argument is that sustainability is time and space specific, and it's frustrating to think about it in those regards, but in my view of the world, that's a reality.
For a while, my go-to definition was sustainability is ethics expanded in time and space.
I love them.
What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Well, that's an interesting one. I don't know that anyone's ever asked me that question. I haven't thought about it very much. At the personal level, it is I have had the great benefit over my academic career of being able to work with a significant number of very, very talented, bright people. I've been involved with over 280 dissertations, for example. And my former students continue to succeed and achieve and do good work. And that fills me with a great deal of satisfaction and pride.
We're writing a book of these conversations. It's called Tomorrow's Heroes. So you're in the mansion. What's the superpower that got you there?
Being able to look at people and see the kindness that lurks within.
That's a good one. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
No.
Were you an activist in the 60s and 70s?
Yes.
What were you active about?
Opposition to the Vietnam War. Racial equity and experience in the United States. Later on, I think I hold, for example, an award from the American Political Science Association for being a mentor for women students. I think I have, and as an administrator at the university, I think that what I'm most proud of was trying to create an environment where, quote-unquote, other voices could be heard and not stigmatized as they were being heard.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
My need to see instances of success in the world, not necessarily my own, but that of others as well, and my determination not to let the forces of despair win.
What's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Saving the American polity from self-destruction.
Last two questions. If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you have happen?
I would find a way to create a level of economic equity such that people could find places and ways to live above the subsistence level and with a minimal level of personal satisfaction. So one of the things we haven't talked about is the homelessness crisis throughout the world, largely in the United States, but throughout the world. I think it's a tragedy of our time.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Well, it sounds a little bit paternalistic, but when you get ready to go to bed at night, you look in the mirror and you say, without being pejorative to myself, what are the things that I did today that I probably shouldn't do tomorrow?
Well, I'm glad that you talked to me today.
Thank you.
You can do it tomorrow as well, if you like.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to Sustainable Lands Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. Each week we talk with somebody making a positive difference, and we try to see the world through their perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Dean Neubauer, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at University of Hawaii, Manoa, and a Senior Adjunct Fellow at the East-West Centre. You can find Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and in all the poddy sorts of places. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and streaming of primo local content. Download the accessmedia.nz app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.